On multiple occasions, she had taken a tenant's entire paycheck. Once, a young mother had offered Sharina her debit card. On 18th and Wright, Mikey was trying to do his homework at the kitchen table. Math. He wasn't confused, just distracted. There was so much noise. Ruby, who could fly through her homework before the bus pulled up to their stop, was practicing the stanky leg in front of the television. Patrice's middle child, Jada, was banging on different things with an empty Mountain Dew bottle. And Natasha was trying to comb Kayla May's hair, typically a 3-hour war. Natasha's belly was growing. The ultrasound had revealed only one baby, a big-headed boy, just as Doreen had guessed. Doreen and Patrice sat around the table, opposite from Mikey, and debated what to do about Sharina's eviction notice. Doreen had had no luck finding another apartment. When she called one number listed in the Red Book, she heard a recorded message that listed pre-qualifications. No evictions in the last 3 years, no money owing to a landlord, no criminal arrests in the last 3 years. Even though Doreen had withheld her rent after the incident with the plumber, they didn't expect Sharina to start the court process so quickly. Patrice thought it was social worker Tabitha's fault. When Doreen told Patrice the reason Sharina had given for the plumbing being neglected, Quentin had lent someone his truck for a month, Patrice rolled her eyes. "You're in Jamaica," she said, "and we can't even take baths. All that money they got? She sound dumb. If I believe that, then slap me dead." Her hand fell hard on the kitchen table, and Mikey's head snapped up from his math problems. Mikey took his papers to Jada and Kayla May's mattress. Before he got back to work, he pulled out a small American flag from its special hiding spot. His teacher had handed the flags out the day Obama was inaugurated. Before that, the north side had been covered in political posters, those dark blue signs planted firmly in lawns, taped to cracked windows, tacked up in people's bedrooms, and lining littered sidewalks. Wright Street had erupted in cheers the night Obama won. Neighbors had unbolted their doors and stepped out on their porches just to look at one another. Mikey stretched out on the mattress, holding the flag at attention, and staring at the ceiling. On the day of her eviction court hearing, January 27th, Doreen limped out of her house and found the bus stop. She had wrapped her head and put on white Velcro sneakers. The shoes felt like they belonged to someone else. Doreen went barefoot when she was inside, which was almost always. She had become as much of a permanent fixture in the apartment as the floorboards and door frames. She hated the idea of taking a bus downtown to eviction court. Plus, her foot was throbbing. The night before, the back door had fallen on it. It first fell on Ruby when she had attempted to prop it back up, pinning her to the ground. When Doreen tried to free her daughter, she slipped, and the heavy door came down on her foot. It had swollen up plump and watery. The doctor on the phone had advised going to the ER, but Doreen refused. "I'm just going to end up waiting all night in that room," she said. Doreen didn't trust doctors any more than her father had. Doreen watched the icy city roll past her bus window. She didn't know how eviction court would go, so she allowed the new baby to occupy her mind. The thought of Natasha as a mother, fickle, youthful Natasha, made Doreen laugh. Doreen remembered when Patrice was born. They delivered her through a cesarean section because she was so big. Doreen had to trade her baby clothes for bigger sizes. Natasha was big, and CJ too. So when Ruby came out weighing only 6 pounds, Doreen didn't know how to handle her. "She made me mad. I couldn't hold her." Natasha had recently applied for W-2, and Doreen worried that it would affect her benefits and cut into the family's food stamps. It would balance out if Natasha stayed in the house and helped pay the bills, but lately, Malik had been asking Natasha if she wanted to move into his mother's place in Brown Deer. Natasha swore there was no way she would, but Doreen sensed that she was seriously considering it. Sharina left later, answering her phone as she drove downtown. A woman on the other end was saying that, during her break, she had walked out of her $10-an-hour temp job at Landmark Credit Union. "Chelsea," Sharina yelled, her voice thick with disappointment. "I don't think that was a good idea. I'm going to talk with you about it when I come out of eviction court, but you know I'm going to fuss at you, right?"
"I know," Chelsea said.
"I'm on you. I'm killing you, Chelsea." Sharina was trying to help Chelsea get her credit together,
For $150, Sharina offered to examine her credit report and use a technique called rapid rescore to improve her score. Clients like Chelsea got their money's worth. Sharina was a hard coach who worked for real results. She knew the value of a good credit score, especially when it came to selling her properties to her clients. Sharina had been dabbling in rent-to-own ventures. She would rent one of her more stable tenants a house for 6 months. During that time, Sharina would attempt to rapid rescore the tenant's credit. If successful, she would then help that tenant secure a loan for the price Sharina was asking for the property. The Federal Housing Administration often required only a 3.5% down payment, which most working tenants could cover with their tax refund. Sharina had seen some of her properties double in value during the housing bubble, and she knew the inflated assessments wouldn't last forever. She was trying to sell a rent-to-own tenant one property for $90,000, a property she owned free and clear, having purchased it at a far lower price. Sharina would reinvest the cash in more properties, and the new homeowner would inherit a massive debt. Sharina would say that was better than not owning a house at all. In years past, Sharina had marketed her credit repair to home loan services to physically and mentally disabled people on SSI. A whole bunch of those people came and bought houses. They ended up losing them, but the thing is, they need to be policed a little bit more. Wasn't nobody saying, Johnny, pay your mortgage? They just may not have been mentally capable. They say the foreclosure crisis started on Wall Street, with men in power ties trading toxic assets and engineering credit default swaps. But in the ghetto, all you needed was a rapid rescore coach and a low-income tenant hungry for a shot at the American dream. When Doreen and Sharina met in the courthouse, Sharina was not in the best of moods. The conversation with Chelsea had annoyed her, and on top of that, the day before, the city had pulled almost $20,000 in water bills and taxes from her bank account. The deduction was unexpected and left Sharina with exactly $3.48 in her business account, $108.32 in her personal account, and a couple of uncashed checks in her pocket. Sharina was not used to being broke, but the first of the month was a few days away. In the hallway outside room 400, Doreen explained that she wasn't trying to scam Sharina by moving out quickly. She was looking for housing to plan for tomorrow. Sharina was already savvy to the story. Unbeknownst to Doreen, Tabitha had called Sharina that morning to plead her client's case. If she got the Hingstons into this mess, she would try to get them out. When it looked like Sharina would agree to a stipulation, Tabitha flattered her by saying, "You are a gangster when it comes to your money." It made Sharina laugh with pride. Sharina drew up a stipulation agreement. If Doreen wanted the eviction dismissed, she would have to pay $400 extra next month and an additional $50 the following 3 months. Doreen signed the papers. Saving for their move would have to wait. 12. Disposable ties. It was the day before Arlene had to be out, and she still hadn't received her welfare check. The family's caseworker at Wraparound had given the boys Christmas gifts. Arlene and their fathers did not. The boys didn't receive anything from their uncles or aunties either, not that they expected to. Arlene's three brothers and one sister had their own kids to worry about. One brother received SSI. Another sold drugs and helped landlords repair properties. The other was out of work. Arlene's sister was trying to raise three kids on what she made as a school bus monitor. Aunt Merva had money. She had held down steady jobs for as long as Arlene could remember and would bring her and her siblings food and gifts when they were children. "We wouldn't never see it," Arlene recalled. Her mother and stepfather got first pickings, but Arlene was not going to call her Aunt Merva for something as frivolous as Christmas gifts or even rent. Over the years, she had learned to ask her favorite aunt for help only during true emergencies, and evictions didn't qualify. If Arlene asked too often or for too much, she would hear about it. Merva might give her a lecture or, worse, stop returning her calls. Sharina assumed Arlene had some sort of family to stay with, but none of Arlene's family members had gone to court with her. None had offered to help her make rent. None had opened their homes to her and her boys. None had offered to help her find another place to live.
They just funny like that, Arlene said. My family don't help. I don't have no one to help me. I search around until I find somebody who will.
When Arlene answered the door, she found Sharina standing on her porch with a woman in a tan winter coat. Sharina, who had a habit of showing apartments before tenants had moved out, asked to come in. She walked a prospective tenant through the apartment, stepping over Arlene's things. When the tour was over, Sharina explained that Arlene had been evicted and would be gone by the next day. The young woman asked where Arlene would go, and Arlene said she didn't know. The young woman took another look around, eyeing the tops of the walls as if judging the soundness of the foundation. She told Sharina she'd take it. Then she looked at Arlene and told her that she and her boys could stay until they found a place. Arlene looked at Sharina, who had raised her eyebrows at the woman. Sharina said it was fine with her. A hand had been extended, and Arlene needed to act quickly before anyone changed their mind. Arlene looked at the woman. She was well-dressed in a full-length skirt and silk head wrap. Her face was warm, with saddle-brown skin that hued darker around her cheekbones. She spoke tenderly and wasn't nasty, foul-smelling, or in tattered clothes. She did look young, and Arlene had overheard her say this would be her first apartment. But Arlene had also gleaned that the woman had come from a Tuesday Bible study. Maybe she wasn't the wild type. Arlene had so many questions, but it was either this option or a shelter. She only had to say, thank you. And the stress that had been consuming her since Christmas would slide off.
Thank you, Arlene said.
She smiled, and the stranger smiled. She hugged the stranger, letting out a small cry. This made the stranger cry. Arlene was so relieved and grateful that she hugged Sharina. Then she asked the stranger her name. Crystal Mayberry moved into 13th Street with only 3 garbage bags of clothes, no furniture, television, mattress, or microwave. Arlene didn't have much, but she had these things and suspected this was why Crystal had allowed her and the boys to stay. Arlene moved Jory and Jafaris into her bedroom. Crystal stored her things in the other bedroom and used it for privacy. But since she didn't have a bed, she slept on Arlene's love seat in the living room. Arlene wasn't planning on staying long, so Crystal didn't ask her to split the rent. Instead, when her check arrived, Arlene gave Crystal $150 and paid her phone and overdue electricity bill. She had enough left over to buy Jory a new pair of sneakers. That felt amazing. Crystal was 18, younger than Arlene's oldest son. She had been born prematurely on a spring day in 1990, shortly after her pregnant mother was stabbed 11 times in the back during a robbery. The attack had induced labor. Both mother and daughter survived. It was not the first time Crystal's mother had been stabbed, for as far back as she could remember, Crystal's father had beat her mother. He smoked crack, and so did her mother, and so did her mother's mother. Crystal was placed in foster care at age 5 and had bounced between dozens of homes. She lived with her Aunt Rhoda for 5 years. Then Aunt Rhoda returned her. After that, the longest Crystal lived anywhere was 8 months. When adolescence arrived, Crystal started getting into fights with other girls in the group homes. She picked up assault charges and a scar across her right cheek. People in their houses, pets, furniture, dishes, these came and went. Food was more stable, and Crystal began taking refuge in it. When Crystal was 16, she stopped going to high school. When she turned 17, her caseworker began transitioning her out of the system. By that time, she had passed through more than 25 foster placements. Crystal was barred temporarily from low-income housing owing to her assault charge, but her caseworker arranged for her to move into an apartment subsidized by a child welfare agency. To keep the apartment, Crystal had to find a job, but she was not the least bit interested in pulling half-day shifts at Quad Graphics or dropping onion rings at Burger King. She submitted a single application. Plus, having been approved for SSI on account of bipolar disorder, Crystal thought that her $754 monthly check was more reliable than any job she could get. After 8 months, the caseworker told Crystal she would have to leave the apartment. Crystal stepped out of foster care and into homelessness. She slept at shelters and on the street. She lived briefly with her grandmother, then a woman from her church, then a cousin. Arlene and Crystal met under peculiar circumstances, but they were engaging in a popular strategy poor people use to pay the bills and feed their children. Especially in the inner city, strangers brushed up against one another constantly, on the street, at job centers, in the welfare building, and found ways to ask for and offer help. Before she met Arlene, Crystal stayed a month with a woman she had met on a bus. In the 1960s and 1970s, destitute families often relied on extended kin networks to get by. Poor black families were immersed in a domestic web of a large number of kin and friends whom they could count on, wrote the anthropologist Carol Stack in All Our Kin. Those entwined in such a web swapped goods and services on a daily basis. This did little to lift families out of poverty, but it was enough to keep them afloat. But large-scale social transformations, the crack epidemic, the rise of the black middle class, and the prison boom, among them, had frayed the family safety net in poor communities. So had state policies like aid to families with dependent children that sought to limit kin dependence by giving mothers who lived alone or with unrelated roommates a larger stipend than those who lived with relatives. The family was no longer a reliable source of support for poor people. Middle-class kin often did not know how to help or did not want to. And poor kin were often too poor or troubled or addicted to lend much of a hand. Legal entanglements got in the way, too. This was why Crystal believed her Aunt Rhoda refused to open her door to her after she aged out of foster care. Rhoda had caught a case for her son, his dope found in her apartment, and was serving 2 years on probation. This meant that law enforcement officers could inspect her apartment. Knowing this, Crystal asked if she could sleep outside on her porch. Rhoda said no. It was next to impossible for people to survive deep poverty on their own. If you could not rely on your family, you could reach out to strangers, make disposable ties. But it was a lot to ask of someone you barely knew. A week after Crystal moved in, Arlene sat at the kitchen table, circling apartment listings in the newspaper and Red Book, skipping the addresses that included background checks. Jafaris played with a caulk gun Quentin had left behind. Arlene's plan was to move by the first of the month. "I don't want to live in the inner city ever again," she said. That first meeting with Crystal had felt like a blessing, so Arlene decided to be picky. What she would love was a two-bedroom downtown apartment for under $525. When Jory walked in the door, Arlene straightened her back. He dragged his backpack into the kitchen with his head bowed, wearing his new shoes. "You already know your teacher called me." Arlene's voice was sharp. Jory tried to explain himself, but Arlene cut him off. "I don't want to hear it, 'cause it's always a problem at every school you go to." "Nah, 'cause he stepped on my shoes. I turned around like you done stepped on mine, and teacher gonna say, 'What you say? What you say?' Everybody in that school, they say the teachers get slick with all the kids." "I ain't trying to hear no excuses." "Because you believe in nothing," Jory snapped back. "That teacher already running on people. Even the teacher cuss at the kids." "All that what you doing, you can stop it," Arlene yelled. Jory sniffed and tried to stop himself from crying. Arlene told him to start his homework, and he sulked back to their bedroom. Grabbing the newspaper, Arlene left to look for apartments, leaving her boys with Crystal. She headed to Tetonia Avenue, a main thoroughfare that cuts diagonally through Milwaukee's north side, and considered the snow. Arlene didn't remember seeing this much snow since she was a child. On Tetonia, she began calling on rent signs. Some landlords didn't answer. Others wanted more rent than she could give. Arlene found herself in the neighborhood where her brother, Martin, lived. She spotted rent signs, but decided to move on. "Martin think he can eat off us any dang minute," she thought. Earlier, Arlene had looked in an area where Jerjer's father lived. She avoided that area, too. "Those are just too close to him." Arlene was able to call on 9 units before she answered her phone and heard Crystal screaming, "You gotta get the fuck out of my house tonight! Tonight! Get your shit and go tonight!" Arlene stayed on the phone a few more seconds, then hung up. "This is too ridiculous," she said to herself. Crystal had said something about Jory being disrespectful, but Arlene sensed Crystal really was saying, "I'm hungry." There was no food in the house, and Crystal had been complaining. Buying food was never part of the bargain, but Crystal was broke and her food stamps cut off. "As long as we have food, she fine," Arlene thought. "But when we don't, it's like this." Arlene stopped at a nearby corner store and ordered a $99 meat deal, an inner-city staple consisting of 45 pounds of chicken wings and legs, pork chops, neck bones, salt pork, pig feet, turkey wings, bacon, and other cuts. The man behind the counter, speaking in Arabic on the phone, threw in two sacks of potatoes for free. Checking out, Arlene added soda and potato chips, paying in food stamps. She received $298 in stamps each month. She paid for a pack of Newport 100s with cash. When Arlene stepped back into the apartment, Jory immediately tried to explain his side of the story. "She talking about putting Jafaris out with no coat on, no shoes, no nothing. Jafaris went outside on his own," Crystal snapped back. "But Jory like, 'Bitch, I'm gonna punch you in your shit. Bitch, I'm gonna do this. Bitch, I'm gonna do that.'" Arlene listened silently, as a mother does when she comes upon fighting children. Jory was saying that he tried to stick up for Jafaris after Crystal threatened to put him outside. Crystal was saying that Jory exploded after she playfully locked them out of the house. "Okay," Arlene said when she had heard enough. "You ain't gonna do nothing to her," she told Jory. Then she turned to Crystal. "And you're not gonna do anything to my child." When Jory tried to speak, Arlene snapped, "And you can shut your mouth." "She not telling you the whole story," Jory pleaded. "Why would you call her bitches, Jory?" Arlene asked. "She was calling me out my name. You know what?" Crystal yelled. "Yeah, I'm a bitch. But remember, I'm that same bitch that opened up my door and let you stay here, even though I didn't know you from Adam and Eve. I was that same bitch that let you in. The landlord didn't care. She don't have to care." "I don't know why you're saying all this, 'cause I know that," Arlene responded, her voice assertive and clear. She sent Jory out for the groceries. Crystal waved her phone in the air. "Whatever my mom says I should do, I'm gonna do, because that's too much disrespect. Too much." Crystal was putting Arlene's fate in the hands of her spiritual mom, an older woman she met at a group home. She dialed the number, pressed the phone to her ear, and kept talking to Arlene. "If he just called me one bitch, that would have been fine. I'd have just chopped it off. But to be called a bitch for an hour straight?" No one picked up. Crystal redialed. Arlene walked to her room and began venting to the ceiling. "She always complaining there ain't no food, but it ain't my responsibility to feed nobody but my kids. Nobody." "I didn't ask you to buy shit for me," Crystal yelled back. "Because please believe it, please, 'cause I'm gonna have whatever I need, whatever. Whether I have to sell some ass, Crystal Shirella Sherrod Mayberry is gonna get whatever she needs, whatever." Arlene looked at her boys. "I'm sick of y'all," she yelled. "If I knew I'd be having to go through this, I would have left. What am I doing? I clean up. I just went and bought food for this house. What am I doing so wrong?" Crystal dialed again. Still no answer. Now it was her turn to talk to the ceiling. She began praying out loud. "God, I need an answer right now. God, please. I need to hear something from my mama, my bishop. God, I promise you, I wish you wouldn't have let me learn to love the way I love. I wish I would have been bitter for all the terrible things that happened in my life. Whoa, Lord." Crystal began singing a hymn. She walked around the apartment, humming and breathing in through her nose. Occasionally, she would pause and close her eyes. She was calming herself down. Arlene looked at Jory. "You disrespecting, and she tell us, 'You gotta go.' Where is we going?" "She," Jory started. "I said, where is we going?" Jory went quiet and began to cry. Arlene had spent down her check and didn't know where she would take her boys if Crystal tossed them out. She looked at Jafaris, who, during the fight, had distracted himself by drawing in a notebook. Two monsters in hats and shoes, one big, the other small. "You know what?" Crystal finally said. Her eyes were brimming with tears, and she was not yelling, but purring in a new voice, hushed and soothing. Let me say something.
Ooh, God, I wish you'd have never gave me the spirit of love. My feelings are hurt from both of y'all, but I can't. I can't put y'all out. 'Cause like I told you, I am filled with the Holy Ghost, and the Holy Ghost telling me not to make y'all leave.
Filled with the Holy Ghost, but does more cussing than a little bit, Arlene mumbled under her breath. To Arlene, it wasn't the Holy Ghost, but the meat cuts and potato chips and love seat that had delivered the message. In the heat of the fight, she had made sure to tell Crystal, I'm not leaving without taking my stuff out of here. Jory sat on his mattress in the bedroom. He felt dejected, and Arlene knew it. Later on, after things were resolved, Arlene sat down next to Jory and tried to explain herself.
What kind of parent am I to just listen to her and not listen to you? She said, softly. But this is what comes when you lose your house. This is what comes.
13. E24. When Beaker found out that Lorraine had moved into his trailer, he cussed from his hospital bed. Angry but helpless, he fingered the scar from his triple bypass, a 9-inch pink worm that puffed up from the middle of his chest. Lorraine was breathing heavily when he got her on the phone. Beaker, she said, we're starting out fresh. I'm throwing everything out. She had spent the morning cleaning the kitchen, tossing the left-out black applesauce and fly-covered ribs, before deciding that everything had to go, even the cans of food because bugs were crawling on them. Beaker suggested Lorraine take the back bedroom, but she refused because it was filthy. She took out her steamer and worked it over the couch. She would sleep on its cushions, next to the mound of things she had rescued from her trailer. When Beaker came home from the hospital, he planted himself at the kitchen table and dashed his cigarettes into a disposable plastic bowl, the kind you fill with olives at the deli. Beaker's real name was Robert, but everyone called him by his childhood nickname. A brooding and taciturn man with slicked back black and gray hair, Beaker had retired from driving a city bus a few years back when his health began to deteriorate. Beaker asked Lorraine to split the rent, but Lorraine said she couldn't because she had to make steady payments to Eagle Moving. They fought, and Beaker settled for Lorraine covering the cable and phone bills. Then they fought over what to watch on television. Beaker preferred shows like Ice Road Truckers. Lorraine demanded, So You Think You Can Dance. Then they fought over Beaker's refusal to share his dinners from Meals on Wheels because he was still miffed that Lorraine threw out his canned food. Lorraine's food stamps had been cut off. In the turmoil of her eviction, she had forgotten about a meeting at the welfare office. So she began asking neighbors for spare plates and visiting church pantries. During her first visit to Eagle, Lorraine gave her name to a black man behind the counter who was wearing a backwards cap and gold crucifix. And when I pay, can I go look at my stuff? Lorraine asked. No, this is a bonded storage, ma'am. I can't let you back there. Riffling through your things and pulling out, say, winter clothing was not allowed. All right. You got the in fee, the out fee, and the first month's storage, the man said. That adds up to $375. Then each month after that, it goes up another $125. The man suggested Lorraine try to get her things out soon so she wouldn't have to pay on another month. But having just given him what amounted to over half her SSI check, Lorraine knew this was impossible. It would take her several months to save for a new apartment, while still paying Beaker and Eagle. In the trailer park, Lorraine tried to lie low and avoid Lenny and Office Susie. She knew that if they found out where she was staying, they would tell Tobin, who might throw her out, and Beaker along with her. Lenny and Office Susie were crucial to Tobin and to his tenants. They could get you evicted just as easily as they could get your toilet working again. Susie pushed for Pam and Scott to be kicked out, but she would also run down the Cadillac and yell at Tobin if she thought he was overcharging someone or moving too slow fixing a porch railing. Most important, Lenny and Susie were cultural brokers, bridging the gap between Tobin and his tenants, and smoothing things over when he crossed the line. Like the time he approached a tenant's kids, telling them their father owed rent. On numerous occasions, Lenny literally placed himself between Tobin and an enraged tenant. This was a common practice. Outsider landlords hiring people from the community, usually their tenants, to manage property. The kids Tobin had approached about the rent belonged to Donnie, a portly and unshaven man in his mid-30s who was liked by almost everyone in the trailer park. Donnie was already refusing to pay Tobin, not because he didn't have the money, but because he felt disrespected. He put his rent in escrow, citing his leaking roof and the black mold under the sink. Said Donnie to his neighbor, Robbie, "You know what he tells me? You rented it as is. Tobin is just too ignorant to know that there are people in here that don't live off Social Security." "Damn right," Robbie spat. "He asked me if I had a job. I said, motherfucker, I work for the union." Robbie was a deep tunnel miner and a member of Local 113. "You gonna treat me like shit? I sure as hell ain't gonna pay you. I don't care who you are. You're not gonna sit there and discriminate me. You know what I mean? 'Cause I'm a redneck. 'Cause you live in a trailer court, period. You're still a fucking human." Lenny was a redneck, too, and understood where the men were coming from. He agreed that the old man was losing it, but he also pushed back. "A lot of people say, Tobin, he's an asshole. But why is he the asshole? You're the one who owes him." What Donnie, Robbie, and the rest of the trailer park didn't know was that Lenny had a financial stake in them paying. Each month, he received a $100 bonus if he collected $50,000. He'd receive an additional $100 for every $2,000 collected after that. Some days would find Lenny walking alongside Roger from the Department of Neighborhood Services, finishing his sentences. Roger, the inspector, glanced down at his clipboard, reviewing notes from his last visit.
"Let's see, W-45 was the shed," Lenny cut in. "We got it out of here."
"Ah."
"Hey, Roger,"
a tenant called out from his porch.
"See anything?"
"Do I see anything?"
Most park residents knew Roger, had his business card tucked away in a kitchen drawer. When they got fed up with some housing problem, they would not threaten to call DNS, but Roger specifically. A balding white man with a well-trimmed beard, Roger wore a white DNS polo shirt and 3330 Levi's.
"Any violations?"
the tenant clarified, trying to be helpful.
"Well, it's not country living, but if it's habitable inside, it looks good to me." "So, there aren't any violations?"
Roger shrugged and kept walking. Of course there were. He had noticed the pile of trash behind the tenant's trailer and a plywood slab where a window should have been. There were trailers with several cracked windows, large steel barrels used for nighttime fires, and trash floating in standing puddles and overflowing from the two giant dumpsters on either end of the park. Tobin had refused to pay for individual trash cans, but the dumpsters would fill up days before they were emptied, attracting raccoons and possums. One resident had stabbed a possum dead a few nights before Roger's visit. Lenny had shot one once. When the garbage collectors came, residents whose trailers faced the dumpsters would try to convince the truck driver to move them to another spot. They would point to a trailer saying, sometimes truthfully, "That one's empty." Roger sighed.
"Man, you gotta keep me from writing up so much shit."
"Well, don't let that hand go then,"
Lenny replied, telling Roger not to record violations.
"Best of intentions, Lenny, best of intentions. Every time I walk through here, there's always something."
And that was only from the outside. Roger's inspections usually did not take him inside trailers, where he would have seen sunken bathtubs propped up with car jacks or water heaters disconnected from ventilating pipes. Roger stopped in front of a trailer.
"These windows look like they're shot."
"Well,"
Lenny replied,
"they don't have the money to buy new windows. So what do you want me to do? I don't want to buy them for them."
The trailer was owner-occupied, meaning its residents were responsible for upkeep.
"I don't want you to have to either. So are we okay?"
"I'm okay with that."
Back in the office, Roger sighed and lowered his head into his palms. Tobin hung up the phone.
"Okay, what's the matter? What do we got?"
"Look," Roger began,
"if you're gonna let trailers that look this bad into your trailer park, you have to make it habitable."
Roger began listing off some of the bigger problems. Garbage,
open storage sheds, broken windows.
Lenny cut in. It's been a tough winter.
I'm not going to write you up on that,
Roger replied, speaking of the cracked windows. He knew cataloging every code violation was neither feasible nor, he suspected, in the tenant's best interest.
Rufus, the junk collector, stepped into the office.
Are we safe?
He asked Roger. Although the city had renewed Tobin's license, many tenants still feared removal.
Yes, Roger answered. Good. Now I don't have to move my giant cat house.
When Rufus's mother died, she owned 72 cats. Rufus was down to 3.
Not long after taking over the trailer park, Beak Management fired Lenny and Susie. After reading his termination letter, Lenny began removing his things from the office in which he had worked for the past 12 years. He gathered his tools and unscrewed his deer antlers from the wall. The door swung open, and a man with sunglasses asked,
"Can I get an extension?"
Lenny paused.
"I don't know," he finally said. "I'm out of here."
What in the past had become routine was now far from certain. A worried look worked over the man's face. He left and told the first person he saw. As news spread, a tremor of fear whipped through the park. Would the new management company honor the deals struck over a handshake? Would rents go up? Would evictions? Some tenants hated Lenny and Office Susie, but at least they were known.
"Ain't gonna get no leeway with this setup," Dawn said. "People that were working at the office worked with people because we're just making poverty over here."
When the news reached Dawn's neighbor, Tam, a 7 months pregnant drug addict, she walked into the office and gave Lenny a long hug. On their last day, Office Susie erased her greeting from the voicemail system, and Lenny laid his heavy ring of keys on the desk. Beak Management replaced Lenny with a recent graduate of the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. At 23, young enough to be Lenny's son, the replacement was clueless and patronizing. But he stuck it out. The new maintenance man quit after a week, saying,
"I mean, 99% of the houses in here are just too far gone. I've been working on mobile houses for 7 years, and I've never worked in a park like this."
With Lenny and Susie gone, Tobin had to take care of some matters himself. It didn't bother him. He'd always been a hands-on landlord. In his 12 years at College Mobile Home Park, Tobin had learned to pull profit out of 131 dilapidated trailers. Most impressive was his ability to transform an utterly trashed trailer into a rent-generating machine in a matter of days, and for next to nothing. After evicting a tenant named Theo and his girlfriend from E24, Tobin needed to have the trailer cleaned out. Theo was known in the park as a never-sweat, a lazy slob who didn't work. His trailer was a disaster. Tobin hired Mrs. Mites to clean it out. Unlike some of the other older residents, who seemed to be waiting to die, swallowing prescription pills and nodding off in front of the television, Mrs. Mites still had plenty of fight left. She and her adult daughter, Meredith, would get into foul-mouthed shouting matches first thing in the morning. While driving to or from their jobs, trailer park residents would sometimes spot Mrs. Mites several miles away from home, pushing a shopping cart brimming over with aluminum cans. She was strong and knew how to work. Mrs. Mites was grateful for the extra money, even if it was E24. She could smell the trailer standing 10 feet away. Inside, the mess was pathological. There were ashtrays and cigarettes on the floor. The sink was piled high with food-encrusted dishes. Black grime had overtaken the toilet. Trash was everywhere. Several spots in the carpet were damp with cat piss, and honey-colored strips of fly tape dangled from the ceiling. Theo and his girlfriend had moved in a hurry, leaving behind piles of stuff, a pair of roller skates, a motorcycle helmet, a couch, a full toolbox, a toy helicopter, a driver's license. Mrs. Mites began hauling everything to the dumpster. After a few loads, she asked Office Susie for a pair of rubber gloves. Rufus, the junk collector, appeared at the door.
"Whoa," he said, looking around. "I hate to say it, but even niggers are cleaner than this."
Mrs. Mites let out a loud, "Ha," and kept working. Rufus was there for the metal.
He had been a full-time junk collector since 1984 and was proud that his life didn't revolve around a mailbox, as it did for his neighbors who waited each month for their SSI checks. Tobin had asked Rufus to pull out the microwave, refrigerator, dryer, and any other large items. He was yanking on the dishwasher when Tobin walked in. Wearing pressed khaki pants and a polo shirt, Tobin narrowed his eyes. He was unfazed, having seen this kind of mess before.
"Okay, Rufus," Tobin said. "Let's get this shit out of here and see where we stand."
It took Rufus 2 hours to load everything into the bed of his old blue Chevy. Tobin didn't pay him anything, but he collected almost $60 from the scrapyard. It took Mrs. Mites 5 straight hours. Tobin paid her $20. Once the trailer was cleared out, Tobin placed an advertisement in the paper. Soon, couples were coming to look, and Tobin offered them the handyman special. He apologized for the condition of the trailer. It still smelled of cat urine and smoke. Some windows were broken, and the black grime on the toilet was still there. But as consolation, he threw in a couple months' free rent. A few weeks after Theo left, Tobin had a new pair of tenants in E24. The couple began to use the money they were saving on rent to fix up their new home. 2 months later, they began paying Tobin $500 a month in lot rent. Office Susie thought Tobin had shortchanged Mrs. Mites, but she didn't say anything. She called Tobin's other workers, who cut the grass or picked up trash for beer money, regular trailer park tramps. Tobin fired the tramps after Alderman Witkowski stipulated he hire outside maintenance help, but some kept on working out of boredom or the hope that Tobin would still pay them something. Troy, a bony, out-of-work motorcycle mechanic, was one of them. He had even helped mop up the sewage spill that had made the news. For that, he got nothing but an earful from his common-law wife, Samantha. "What are we supposed to do?" Samantha had yelled in her uniform from George Webb, a Wisconsin-based chain restaurant that served breakfast all day long. They were behind in rent and were hoping that Tobin would credit them something for Troy's 8 hours of puke work, even if Tobin had not hired him for the job.
"You cleaned up shit. Human shit."
"I'll tell you," Troy said.
"I've cleaned up horse shit when I was shoveling stables. I've cleaned up chicken shit, but I ain't never had to clean up human shit. It was terrible."
"I know, 'cause you smelled bad."
Samantha took a breath.
"I'm a bitch," she continued.
"I'm a bitch, and Troy, you don't got no bitch in you."
Troy dropped his head in quiet agreement, taking a sip of a milkshake that Samantha had brought home from work.
"Tobin wants to whine and cry all the time," he said. "The guy's filthy rich, and he still wants money. He makes more than $1 million on this park."
He gestured toward the line of trailers.
"Add it up."
Alderman Witkowski had quoted a similar number, estimating that Tobin's trailer park netted more than $900,000 a year. Both Troy and Witkowski arrived at that figure by multiplying Tobin's 131 trailers by the average monthly rent, $550. It was a sloppy calculation that assumed Tobin didn't have any expenses or vacancies and that his tenants always paid their rent in full. Tobin didn't have a mortgage. He had bought the trailer park for $2.1 million in 1995 and paid it off 9 years later. But he did have to pay property taxes, water bills, regular maintenance costs, Lenny's and Office Susie's annual salaries and rent reductions, advertising fees, and eviction costs. After accounting for these expenses, vacancies, and missing payments, Tobin took home roughly $447,000 each year, half of what the alderman had reported. Still, Tobin belonged to the top 1% of income earners. Most of his tenants belonged to the bottom 10%. Troy finished the milkshake.
"Did that hit the spot, baby?"
Samantha asked, rubbing his shoulder. 14. High Tolerance. Scott had no intention of fighting his eviction. He skipped his court date and never talked to Tobin about it. Instead, he focused his efforts on finding another place to live. After several calls, Pito from Narcotics Anonymous came through. Pito worked with landlords, repairing and filling their properties, and vouched for Scott to one he knew. The two-bedroom upper was on the near south side. It was small and bare with a treacherous balcony and no shower. but the landlord was only asking $420 a month and didn't bother with a background check. The apartment also came with Pito's nephew, who went by DP. A baby-faced 19-year-old with several tattoos and earrings, DP had recently been released from prison, where he was serving time for weapons possession and tampering with a firearm. He had sawed off the barrel of a shotgun. DP ran with the Cobras and wanted a gun in case things heated up with the Kings. In prison, he got his GED and another tattoo that read, Beginning. One day, Pito learned from another landlord that an old man had died in a nearby trailer park and no one had come to claim his things. So he arranged for Scott and DP to clean out the trailer in exchange for them keeping whatever they wanted. In the dead man's closet, Scott had found a pressed suit in a zipped garment bag and a silk-lined suitcase. In the bathroom, he had learned the man's name from mailing stickers on American Legion magazines. But Scott found the cigarette burns next to the bed most revealing. They led him to speculate that the man was on morphine. In Scott's mind, drugs explained a lot about the world. Why this man had died alone, why Pam and Ned got tossed from the trailer park, and why he was in a stranger's home collecting shabby furniture for his apartment. The new roommates loaded a dresser and sofa onto the oily bed of a Ford F-150. When the truck was full, DP started the engine and turned on loud rap music. Scott would have preferred something else. His favorite song was Salisbury Hill by Peter Gabriel. But he didn't say anything. Scott was still on Mira's crew, but work had slowed. Mira had run through her jobs too quickly by working her men 12 hours a day, lugging washers and dryers, mattresses, sleeper sofas. When workers said they were exhausted or sore, Mira sold them painkillers. But Scott thought she charged too much. When he needed relief, he would ask heroine Susie to meet him somewhere. I want to do what Pito's doing, DP said. I want to come home clean and leave the house clean. I can't see myself at 30 doing this bullshit. Scott couldn't either, years ago, when he was DP's age. After unloading the furniture, DP and Scott shared a beer on their front steps. The apartment was on Ward Street, on the west side of Kinnickinnick Avenue, which the locals shortened to KK. It faced an undeveloped plot of land surrounding railroad tracks and was not far from an apartment Scott used to rent years ago when he was still a nurse and living in Bayview, a thriving neighborhood that attracted young professionals, artists, and hipsters. From their stoop, Scott and DP could see the crowning dome of the Basilica of St. Josephat. 100 years ago, Polish parishioners had emptied their savings accounts to fund the massive building project, a scaled-down version of St. Peter's in Rome. As Scott drank his beer, he joked about taking his own vow of poverty. All I'm going to do is buy some food and clothes and some drugs now and again. DP said nothing. Damn, Scott said after the moment had passed. My neck and back are killing me. His shifts with Mira were beginning to take a toll. Why don't you go to the doctor? DP asked. Because I don't think there's anything they can do. Scott paused. They could give me Percocet. Too bad I'd eat them all in one day. Scott still bought his Vicodin at the trailer park. He thought Mrs. Mites was the only adult there who didn't do drugs or have a history with them. Scott loved drugs. Being high was a mini vacation from his shame of a life. He took the trip whenever he could afford it. Scott had gotten high with Pam and Ned shortly before they received their eviction notice and had moved in a hurry, leaving behind a couch, beds, dressers, and other large items. Scott figured Ned and Pam got what was coming to them. In his old life, before the fall, he might have been more sympathetic. But he had come to view sympathy as a kind of naivete, a sentiment voiced from a certain distance by the callow middle classes. They can be compassionate because it's not their only option, he said of liberals who didn't live in trailer parks. As for Ned and Pam, Scott thought their eviction came down to their crack habit, plain and simple. Heroine Susie agreed with him. There's a common denominator for all evictions, she said. I almost got evicted once. Use the money for other things. Trailer park residents rarely raised a fuss about a neighbor's eviction, whether that person was a known drug addict or not. Evictions were deserved, understood to be the outcome of individual failure. They
helped get rid of the riffraff, some said. No one thought the poor more undeserving than the poor themselves. In years past, renters opposed landlords and saw themselves as a class with shared interests and a unified purpose. During the early 20th century, tenants organized against evictions and unsanitary conditions. When landlords raised rents too often or too steeply, tenants went so far as to stage rent strikes. Strikers joined together to withhold rent and form picket lines, risking eviction, arrest, and beatings by hired thugs. They were not an especially radical bunch, these strikers. Most were ordinary mothers and fathers who believed landlords were entitled to modest rent increases and fair profits, but not price gouging. In New York City, the great rent wars of the Roaring Twenties forced the state legislature to impose rent controls that remain the country's strongest to this day. Petitions, picket lines, civil disobedience. This kind of political mobilization required a certain shift in vision. For a protest movement to arise out of the traumas of daily life, the sociologists Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward have observed, the social arrangements that are ordinarily perceived as just and immutable must come to seem both unjust and mutable. This usually happened during extraordinary times, when large-scale social transformations or economic disturbances, the post-war housing shortage, say, profoundly upset the status quo. But it was not enough simply to perceive injustice. Mass resistance was possible only when people believed they had the collective capacity to change things. For poor people, this required identifying with the oppressed and counting yourself among them, which was something most trailer park residents were absolutely unwilling to do. During rent strikes, tenants believed they had a moral obligation to one another. If tenants resisted excessive rent hikes or unwarranted evictions, it was because they invested in their homes and neighborhoods. They felt they belonged there. In the trailer park, that sentiment was almost dead. For most residents, Scott among them, the goal was to leave, not to plant roots and change things. Some residents described themselves as just passing through, even if they had been passing through nearly all their life. One, an out-of-work father of three who powered his trailer with stolen electricity, said, "We don't let family come here. It's not us. It's lower-class living, and I didn't come from this." Lenny's ex-wife, who being Lenny's ex-wife was virtually married to the trailer park at one time, liked to tell people, "You forget that I'm the one that used to go to the opera." Tam, the pregnant drug addict, thought of the trailer park as a hotel. Poor neighborhoods provided their residents with quite a lot. In the trailer park, residents met people who knew how to pirate cable when the best food pantries were open, and how to apply for SSI. All over the city, people who lived in distressed neighborhoods were more likely to help their neighbors pay bills, buy groceries, fix their car, or lend a hand in other ways, compared to their peers in better-off areas. These exchanges helped people on the receiving end meet basic material needs, and they helped those on the delivering end feel more fully human. But for such vital exchanges to take place, residents had to make their needs known and acknowledge their failures. For Lorraine to ask her neighbor if she could use her shower, she needed to explain that her gas had been shut off. That fact became public when she walked back to her trailer with wet hair. On another occasion, a tenant named Rose had her children taken by Child Protective Services. Trailer park residents sat beside her as she wailed. They comforted her and made sure she didn't hurt herself, but because they saw what had happened, they also judged her. "It ain't nothing to be proud of," Dawn told her. "But the Lord took them for some reason." When people began to view their neighborhood as brimming with deprivation and vice, full of all sorts of shipwrecked humanity, they lost confidence in its political capacity. Milwaukee renters, who perceived higher levels of neighborhood trauma, believing that their neighbors had experienced incarceration, abuse, addiction, and other harrowing events, were far less likely to believe that people in their community could come together to improve their lives. This lack of faith had less to do with their neighborhood's actual poverty and crime rates than with the level of concentrated suffering they perceived around them. A community that saw so clearly its own pain had a difficult time also sensing its potential. Every so often, Tobin's tenants would air a passing remark about their landlord's profits or call him a greedy Jew.
That Cadillac got some shiny rims. I know they didn't cost no $10.
He just wants to butter his pockets. But for the most part, tenants had a high tolerance for inequality. They spent little time questioning the wide gulf separating their poverty from Tobin's wealth, or asking why rent for a worn-out aluminum-wrapped trailer took such a large chunk of their income. Their focus was on smaller, more tangible problems. When Witkowski reported Tobin's annual income to be close to $1 million, a man who lived on the same side of the park as Scott said,
"I'd give two shits. As long as he keeps things the way he's supposed to here, and I don't have to worry about the freaking ceiling caving in, I don't care."
Most renters in Milwaukee thought highly of their landlord. Who had time to protest inequality when you were trying to get the rotten spot in your floorboard patched before your daughter put her foot through it again? Who cared what the landlord was making as long as he was willing to work with you until you got back on your feet? There was always something worse than the trailer park, always room to drop lower. Residents were reminded of this when the whole park was threatened with eviction, and they felt it again when men from Beek Management began collecting rents. It had been a bad week. First, Scott lost his keys and decided to break into his apartment by putting a fist through the front window. Then his electricity went out. Then Mira fired him. Nothing personal. She had found a crew of hypes willing to work for $25 a day. In N.A., Scott had learned that addiction tightened its grip when you were hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Halt. And Scott was all for. After Mira fired him, he used part of his last paycheck to get drunk and high at a friend's house. That's when he called his mom, a hospital housekeeper in rural Iowa. On the phone, Scott told his mother about his drinking, but not the heroin, and about losing his nursing license after getting hooked on painkillers. She knew none of it. Scott hadn't spoken to his mother in over a year.
"Mom?"
Scott was crying.
"I'm sorry. I'm a mess. I'm a fucking mess."
Before Scott could finish, his mother cut him off, failing to realize that it took everything he had in him, and a 12-pack, to dial all 10 numbers and not hang up when he got to the 7th or 9th, like he usually did. She explained that she was in a van full of relatives and unable to talk at the moment. They were all going to Branson, Missouri for the weekend. "But Scott," she said, "you know that you can always come home." Scott thought about her offer. How could he get to Iowa with no car and no money for a train ticket? And how could he find heroin there? After a day, the sick would start working its way through his body. Then there was the part about being an object of pity. Scott thought about this as he walked through Pick and Save the day after the call. He had offered to buy heroin Susie lunch with his food stamps if she'd give him a hit. "I mean, I could go back home, but damn, I'm 40 fucking years old. I'd have to go back and tell them, you know, that I fucked my whole fucking life up." Scott had never reached out to his family for help. He considered their lawns and jobs and children and normal problems and concluded they wouldn't know what to do. How much help could they possibly be? Middle-class relatives could be useless that way. Scott joined the checkout line and noticed the man in front of him was buying Robitussin. "You got a cold?" Scott asked.
"Yeah," the man said. "Can't seem to shake it."
He coughed as if to prove his point.
"Here,"
Scott said. He took out a pen and scrap of paper and wrote vitamin C, zinc, and echinacea.
"That's what I would recommend," he said.
Scott didn't go back to Iowa. Instead, he decided to go to rehab. On the morning he planned to check himself in, Scott woke up while it was still dark, trimmed his beard, and tucked in his t-shirt. He wanted to climb back out. He felt nervous, but ready. When Scott stepped out of the elevator at 7 a.m., an hour before the clinic's doors opened, he saw that he was late. 15 people were already in line. There were older black men who had dressed up for the occasion, a foul-mouthed white woman, 50 perhaps, in cowboy boots, a pair of young Mexican men sitting on their feet and whispering in Spanish, a 20-something black man whose pants were falling down, a brooding white teenager who had pulled her bangs over her eyes and her sleeves over her hands. Scott slumped against the wall at the end of the line. After a few minutes, the elevator opened again,
and an older Mexican woman stepped out. Her hair was long and black, except for a streak of gray down the middle. She wore a walking cast and